In the following conference, Father John A. Hardin, S.J., speaks on the subject, How to Teach Mental Prayer. Father Hardin.
It might be valuable, before we get into the subject of mental prayer proper, to address ourselves to the nature of prayer, the types and what I call forms of prayer, and then zero in on mental prayer in particular. Over the years, I have found the simplest definition of prayer that covers every possible form is to say that prayer is a voluntary response to the awareness of God's presence. There must then first be a mental awareness of God's presence. He is present, whether I'm aware of it or not. But I begin to pray when I am aware of His presence. All prayer, therefore, begins in the mind. Assuming that awareness of God's presence is not yet prayer, I must somehow respond to that presence. And I do so freely and voluntarily, depending on how freely or generously I respond to that awareness, I am more or less intensely praying. Now, the two general types. We commonly distinguish between vocal and mental prayer, where by vocal prayer we understand that prayer in which I use someone else's words and not my own. They may be the words of Scripture, the words of Christ, the words of the Church, or simply of someone else than myself. When I use those words, I am said to be praying vocally, whether I am literally vocalizing or not. Mental prayer, as distinct from vocal, is where the words or the expression in the prayer is of my own making. And then we distinguish within mental prayer meditation and contemplation, which I have found it convenient to say that in meditation, the mental prayer is a prayer of reasoning. In contemplation, it is a prayer of looking. When I meditate, I am reflecting. I am thinking out, thinking through, analyzing. When I am contemplating, I am, as it were, done with the meditation, and I now dwell on the fruit of my meditation. In Latin, we distinguish between the two forms of prayer by saying that while the mind is used both in meditation and in contemplation, the faculty of the mind, which is used in meditation, is the ratio, the reason, whereas in contemplation, the faculty of the mind, which is used, is intellectus. You might roughly say reason and intelligence, but the vocabulary in English isn't much help. The Latin is very clear. Ratio means I am still working towards the grasp of the truth. Once I have the truth and I behold it, I look at it, I steep myself in it. I, as it were, lose myself in it. That is contemplation. I still want to note the two principal forms of prayer. They can be, that is, our prayers can be either private or liturgical. I suppose the simplest description of private prayer is that it's not liturgical. It is said either alone, in privacy, and or especially, it is that form of prayer which has not become the church's official prayer. Liturgical prayer, and this is the simplest definition, the official public prayer of the church, where the three operative words in liturgical prayer are official, public, and of the church. With that as a sort of backdrop, let's now look at mental prayer proper. What are some of the basic needs that in teaching or training people for mental prayer should be brought to their attention, and that if it is our responsibility to teach them, to make sure they learn? The first basic need for all prayer, and especially for mental prayer, is a deep faith. Is there a special need for deep faith in mental prayer, more so than in vocal prayer? I think so. Why? Because in vocal prayer, the person may be praying and vocalizing, or at least expressing him or herself in words, and feel quite satisfied, even though the faith is not all that active. But in mental prayer, either your faith is operative or you're not praying. Moreover, the deeper the faith, the more intense the mental prayer. Secondly, we're talking about basic needs. Memory. Memory is an indispensable element in the practice and development of mental prayer. Why is that true? Because unless I have on my mind, and before I begin to pray, certain things on which I am to reflect, whether in reasoning or in contemplative fashion, notice, mental prayer spans both, then it'll be a constant struggle to even keep something religious or spiritual on my mind. In other words, the memory must be fairly well stocked with available material on which to meditate or about which to contemplate. It is a good idea, and St. Ignatius thinks it is indispensable, to not trust to one's passive memory when beginning mental prayer, but to make sure to remind oneself of what may already be on the mind in order to bring to the surface some particular aspect of what I wish to meditate on or contemplate about, drawing on things that are already part of my deposit of faith. This is one reason that I think it is a good idea early in the religious life to encourage and even to get the religious into the practice of memorizing. I think I told you from the time that I began teaching the Missionaries of Charity in the Bronx, I can't imagine how much they've memorized. All I know is it's a lot in 4 years. It used to be every week for the first 2 years. They began to complain to the superior, this is too much. So I was asked, could I cut down to the amount of memory? So I said, all right. So it's now every 2 weeks. And right after prayer, they all have their half sheets of paper, and it usually takes about this much. Every 2 weeks, they write out this much of the scriptures. Well, 40 to 50 times a year, as it used to be for 2 years, 100 half sheets, and now another 100 half sheets. That's 200 they have memorized. I'm not sure how much they remember still. And these are the postulants and novices. What things are simply good to memorize? And younger people often have very retentive memories. Nature seems to bless younger people with good memories. As we get older, the Lord, in His mercy, enables us to forget. It's a special gift of advanced years. And it's just as well. I call it selective memory, where you forget certain things, and in God's providence, I've discovered those are the things I should have forgotten in the first place. So cultivate the memory. I consider this part of the spiritual life. So, like what? First and most obviously, the scriptures. It shouldn't be indiscriminate, should be itself selective, but don't hesitate burdening the memory. The human psyche is so arranged, it will never remember more than it can retain. Just one observation. The most important single factor in memorizing is the will. What we want to remember, we remember. What we want to forget, it's remarkable how conveniently we forget. Then, some of the basic prayers of the church. I'm told a lot of young people coming into religious life don't even know some of the basics of, you might say, ordinary Catholic living. So prayers, both those for private and liturgical recitation, should be memorized. And the beauty of this is, it gives you a disciplinary tool for early training, which is invaluable. There are certain things that are simply expected. Then, certain facts of the church's history, it is good to memorize. For example, the dates. I think every novice should have at least 50, I would suggest 100 Catholic dates in his or her memory. The great events of the Church's history. May I ask, brother, when did the Second Vatican Council open?
Was it turned in
1963? It opened in 1960?
June?
Well, October. Really, in October, but at least 1962. When was Pope John Paul II elected? Sister Linda, what year?
Eight.
Would you even possibly remember the day?
October
the 16th. Isn't it a fact that in secular matters, our memories are just cluttered with facts? Some of the biblical figures should be known who they are. Where, for example, Abraham came from. Where did Abraham come from? All right. Of what? Of what nation of people?
The Chaldeans.
Well, all I'm saying is, doesn't this make sense?
Yeah.
And people can go through their religious life 40, 50 years and not know some of the basics, as I would call them, of the history of salvation. For example, I've discovered, and I used to do this until I felt I was embarrassing the religious too much. Whenever I start teaching a class of religious, say novices, one of my first memory exercises, without announcing it beforehand, I would ask them to give me the names of the 12 apostles. Do you know, out of 30 or 40, I was lucky to get one or two that had every one of them? It's remarkable. Especially when you get into the refinements. Like Simon, or Nathaniel, or Thaddeus. And they repeat the same man under a different title twice. And miss one of the apostles in the process. So memory. And the beauty of this is that the effort expended in memorizing these, you might call them, essentials of our faith is pleasing to God, and the beauty is that then the mind is going around with a manual of meditation. All you need is your mind.
You know, Father, I think that's so important that you should stress that, because in that document on the catechesis by John Paul, he emphasized so much the importance of memorization and the instruction of catechesis.
Yes. And so, certain articles of the faith, the answers to certain questions. I've turned in, I think, since our last class, the manuscript of the Question and Answer Catechism to the publisher. And we're going to take certain parts today because we're going to be on penance, I hope, in our class on the sacraments. Clear, simple, concise expressions of our faith. Because if I cannot, for example, define something in which I believe, my meditation can be very vague, very confused, because my mind is not clear what I'm meditating on.
Would you not say, Father, that your spiritual reading is the most important part of the foundation for any kind of prayer?
Well, I'd say it is important.
Insofar as that, I would think that if you don't do your reading, that you're not praying.
I would say, brother, I would distinguish. I think in general you are right. and we're going to talk about spiritual reading. But people differ immensely. And I'm thinking of my mother, who was just a master in mental prayer. Practically never read anything through a sixth grade education. She just was not academically inclined. So it is true that during the day, the mind should somehow be directed towards or nourished by spiritual thoughts. I think in a literary culture like ours, reading is the ordinary nourishment, spiritual reading. You're right. Especially, I would say this, spiritual reading is indispensable for those who do a fair amount of secular reading. Otherwise, their minds are going to be so filled with secular thoughts that spiritual thoughts, even when they sit down or kneel down to pray, it'll take them so long to collect their thoughts to get into God's presence. So in general, you are right.
Could I just also say, ask you or say this? Would you not also say that St. Ignatius, when he refers to mental prayer and contemplation, he has the same thing in mind, insofar as that he is lifting his he develops the picture and works from there.
Well, yes, except we can theologically, and we should distinguish between the one process and the other. Remember, too, with Ignatius or any of the great spiritual masters, they move so quickly from one to the other, first of all, because of who they are, and secondly, in any given, say, hour of prayer, mental prayer, we could hardly say, I am now meditating, and then now I'm beginning to contemplate. Now, for Ignatius, to make sure that no period of mental prayer would ever remain merely meditation, but become also contemplative, he provided what he called the colloquy, where I engage in conversation with God or Our Lady or someone, where the assumption is I am mentally looking at Christ, addressing myself to him, and no longer reasoning or engaging in what is called discursive reflection.
Yes.
And then he would say, if you find fruit at any stage in what he might call meditation, don't continue your reflections or your analytic reasoning, but just stay there. But for our purpose, we had better distinguish between the two, because the one is not the other. And there are some people, and this is also good to hear, there are some people, and even saints, compare two men, both great saints in the church's calendar, John of the Cross and Vincent de Paul. You cannot imagine two men whose form of mental prayer was more different. For John of the Cross, it was, I would say, always contemplative. I don't believe there were two consecutive sentences of reasoning in John of the Cross. He's always looking at God, looking at Christ, beholding the mysteries of the faith, and just thrilled with what he sees and shares with you his vision. Please?
The gift of contemplation, that's a gift from God.
Yes. And you can work at it, but it must be given. Vincent de Paul, I don't remember two consecutive sentences of what I would call mystical contemplation in Vincent de Paul. His conferences to his religious and his own prayer life, he was always thinking, always planning. He was talking to God about all the poor people that he was going to take care of. Lord, what can I do? How can I improve my work? We've got problems. Lord, help me to solve them. So it is important, lest we get the idea, which would be mistaken, that we are not praying as well as we might because we are not always on the contemplative level. And this is where I think I mentioned that in our own novitiate, we were forbidden by the novice master to read John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, Catherine of Siena, except with special permission. As I look back, I might say to myself, I know we thought then, gosh, we're being deprived of some of the treasury of the church. Well, we weren't told never to read them, but we had to get the book from the novice master. He'd give it to us. And he told us more than once. In other words, I'm reflecting my Ignatian training, that you start the young religious on the counsels of Teresa or the commentary on the Canticle of Canticles of John of the Cross. And these poor dears are just not mystics. And they can find dry, insipid, tasteless, and worst of all, useless. The down-to-earth prayer of Alfonso Liguori, Lord, make haste to help me. I'm in trouble. Then for the next hour, you tell God about your troubles. And having dealt in dealing with some very saintly souls, all I know is they are not all contemplatives. So, yes, mental prayer is both, and the distinction, though it may seem theologically subtle, I think is very practically important. Any other comments?
If you think about the shared prayer, you know, for instance, okay, you read a piece of scripture and then you share it with somebody else, you know.
Well, shared prayer, first of all, would not be, in our technical sense, mental prayer,
no.
Except I suppose if it is spontaneous shared prayer. Well, let me make two observations. First of all, personally, it does not appeal to me.
Maybe there are some people that they really wish for, you know.
Shared prayer as such, I think, for certain people can be legitimate. The problem, however, now with shared prayer is that it has become, in fact, a synonym for Pentecostal and charismatic prayer. And as I think I quoted to you, Mother Teresa, when some of her sisters were Pentecostals in New York, and I happened to be in Rome on business at the time, she was there, and you tell the superior back home, I want no active charismatics in my community. I think the Lord has given me a special charism in every country where these people enter the community, they become a problem. Third, this is basic need. For mental prayer, it is wise to choose someone, either mystery of the faith, or you won't expect this, mystery in my own life. The word mystery has two very different meanings. There are mysteries that God has revealed, that because they are mysteries, they cannot be fully understood. There are mysteries in each one of our lives. The mystery of my own personality, the mystery of the people that God sends into my life, the mystery of a trial that I want to believe it's from God, and there's no way I can fully understand it. But there's also no question that I have to live with it. And in my estimation, the hardest mysteries to live with are not the mysteries of faith, but the mysteries in our own lives. They are also mysteries of faith, but we don't identify them with the Trinity or the hypostatic union. It's the mystery of, Lord, I don't understand why of all people this person should have entered my life. Or of all jobs or positions to be given, why this?
Excuse me, Father, I just would like to clarify something if you would for me. When you're speaking about contemplation in this particular sense, you're talking about it in its method sense, not in its general sense, correct? The reason I say that is because I'm listening to you and I'm thinking in terms of, see, some people would say, as you just said, you know, some people are called contemplative prayer, some people are not. And the reason I say that is that I think religious life, for instance, in its nature is contemplative, and if people don't look at it and as what I feel you're coming across as, they're going to say, well, then, you know,
yes. In other words, what I am talking about now, because we are talking about the how. This is a semester course which is very useful on contemplation. So we are not now analyzing contemplation in general, where the generic term contemplation, or the contemplative dimension, as it's called, of the spiritual life is of the essence of religious life. Anything having to do with man's relationship to God can legitimately be called contemplative, as distinctive from the active or the apostolic, which has to do with my relationship either to myself or more commonly, with my neighbor. That is not the sense in which I'm using the term here. So, in order to engage in formal mental prayer, no spiritual master omits stressing the importance of being specific. Now, sometimes, depending on, say, the trial in my life, I don't have to go into any kind of, well, planned effort. I don't have to read a book of meditations to know what I'm going to meditate on during, say, this period of formal prayer. I can't get it off my mind. But even there may be a cluster of problems on my mind. And it is great wisdom to tell the Lord, Lord, I've got, as far as I can tell, six major problems, six mysteries in my life. I could, of course, just for the next half hour, complain to you or pity myself. I think you will be more pleased if I choose one of those six. And you may not be in the mood to choose among these problems in your life. Nevertheless, select one, concentrate on that during the period of mental prayer, and watch this. The most important single grace of mental prayer is light for the mind. I repeat, the most important single grace, which is to be the fruit of mental prayer, is light for the mind. Some people jump to the affective side, tell God how much they love Him, and He never tires hearing. As you tell them, "My God, I love you." But He might well remind us, "If you love me, keep my commandments." And in all of our lives, it is doing God's will that is the source of our trials in life. And on the level of doing God's will, it is not so much, surely not for religious, the whether I should do God's will, or in what is God's will. That's the problem. I know God's will all too well. The problem is how. And for that I need light. In other words, by concentrating on some one mystery, and I think the word mystery spans all contingencies, whether it can be, and for many people, this is what they prefer. Read a passage in the scriptures, "Without me you can do nothing," which is the mystery of the necessity of grace. And they can just lose themselves in that. For others, it is the mystery of daily living. It is still wise to be more specific than generic. Then, in terms of basic need, what I call the attitude of prayer, what I've also called the when of prayer. When, as you remember, say in Matthew's Gospel, the disciples came to Jesus and asked Him, "Lord, teach us to pray." His answer was, "When you pray, say," and then He gave us the Lord's Prayer. There should be in every person's life the whens of prayer. In other words, that I somehow cut myself off. I do something, but I better do something which will put aside for the time being other laudable interests, even grave concerns, and now I'm going to pray. Placing oneself, as the expression goes, into the presence of God is, I don't want to say the most basic need, but one of the most important practices when we begin prayer. Know that you've started praying, that you're no longer doing whatever you were doing before. Do something dramatic. I think I told you Ignatius tells his disciples to, first of all, make an act of the presence of God. Lord, grant that all the actions, operations, and intentions of this spiritual exercise may tend solely to the praise and glory of your name, or some equivalent, than to perform some physical action. You're in your room, you close the door, you become quiet. As I think I told you, what I do is genuflect on both knees and kiss the ground. I'm telling you this, though I try to make sure that nobody sees me doing this. You make an act of the presence of God. You may have seen pictures of Muslims during their five times a day making their, well, obeisance towards Allah. Bowing, hands outstretched. Do something when you begin to pray.
Whenever I see Pope John Paul do that, if he goes into a country, I think to myself, he must have that practice that you have. Because I don't think he could do it on occasion. He's used to doing it,
I'm sure.
That must be a practice.
And once it gets into a person's system, it becomes habitual. In other words, what I'm doing, say when I genuflect or kiss the ground, I am externalizing what should be an internal kneeling and act of adoration. And we are a piece. Our body is connected, to say the least, with our soul. Brother?
I was going to say, Father, just one thing really that speaking, I suppose, really from my very brief, really, experience, and would you not say that when you go into prayer, just to tell the Lord, look, your problems, and like, sort of, do this on a rather continual basis, it can be a sort of licking your wounds, as it were, before the Lord.
On that level,
do you understand,
frankly,
what I'm trying to say?
Well, I think I do.
And that isn't prayer.
Of course, I would have to say, what's wrong with licking your wounds before the Lord? First of all, I've got wounds, and He knows me, how well He knows me.
Sure.
And so, the essence of prayer is not informing God. He already knows. The essence of prayer, the metaphysical essence of prayer, is total submission of the human spirit before the Almighty. And God doesn't need our prayer, but we do. In other words, there's only one congenital disease that we all have, and that is pride. What prayer is and should be is a concentrated awareness of a fact of my existence. Now, there is nothing, for example, that cannot be abused. I guess it's possible to drink too much water. I know it's possible to wash your hands too often. I've seen people washing their hands, at least I've read about it, not a dozen, but 20 or more times a day. So I'm sure. I've seen people, after they lick the stamp and put it on the envelope, and they press, so they pound it. So there is nothing, you're right, brother, there is nothing that cannot get out of hand, including these acts of subordination.
But what I would want to say, you know, really is, it's something you really, for those in formation, you need to, like, guard the young religious against it.
Well, maybe, I suppose you do, but But I dare say most people nowadays, and that would include those entering religious life, otherwise good Catholics, are so involved and immersed in the secular world that what we're talking about here, I don't think would be too much for them. And if some of the guests slightly out of hand, well, all right.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.